It is not the wind that begets," Potiphar said. "Say not so, O my lord, in your greatness. Often, so I have heard, the sweet breath of Zephyr visits the birds before the close time is at hand. For it is the breath of God's spirit, and the wind is spirit. And as Ptah's sculptors fill the world with beautiful forms, and no one can tell whether their activity is to be called male or female, because it is both and neither, or in other words, is virgin fruitful, so too is the world full of fructifying, and bringeth forth without sex, from the fructification of the breath of God. The Father and Creator of the world is God. He creates all living things, not because they are brought forth from seed, but the unbegotten, in other ways, lays a source of fruitfulness within matter, which changes it and alters it into the manifold. For all the manifold shapes of things were first present in the thoughts of God, and the Word, born by the breath of God, is their begetter." It was a strange scene, one never before enacted in the Egyptian's house or court. Potiphar stood leaning on his staff and listening. On his fine features, the expression of tolerant irony which they habitually sought to wear struggled with a gratification strong enough that it might be called joy, or even happiness. It was, in fact, so strong that one may scarcely speak of it struggling with the irony, since joy obviously took the upper hand. Beside him stood Montcalm, with a little wedge-shaped beard, steward of the house, staring with his little inflamed eyes with the great puffy tear-sacks underneath, incredulous, dazed, grateful, and with appreciation which was nearer to wonder, he looked into the face of this bought slave, this lad, who was doing something which love had taught himself to do for their noble master, and in a higher, finer, and far more effective way. Then behind him was Dudu, spouse of Jesset, most self-righteously enraged, because the master had been deaf to his warning, and prevented from entering fresh objection and interrupting the interview by Potiphar's complete absorption in Joseph's words. The puppy was obviously cutting a good figure, and the dwarf proportionately disadvantaged. It seemed to him that the things the slave was saying, shameless, really not allowable things, which Potiphar was drinking in as though they were the water of life, detracted in some way from his own dignity, and were calculated to weaken it and his influence over certain of the small and certain of the great. As for the small, there was Beauty, the midget, his face wrinkled with delight at his favorite success, fairly swollen with satisfaction because the lad had known how to improve his chance and prove that he had a right to it. Then there were the two scribes, to whom nothing of the kind had ever happened before in their lives, and who had ceased to smile, instructed by diligent study of their master's face and that of Montcalm, as well as by their own impressions of what they had heard. And beside his tree, before this group of listeners, stood Joseph, a smile on his lips, and perorated most enchantingly. He had long since abandoned the humble posture which at first had constrained him, and stood in easy grace, accompanying with pleasing and eloquent gesture the words which flowed unsought from his lips, as with blithe seriousness he discoursed upon the higher procreation and the fruitful power of the breath of God. In the gathering twilight, among the columns of this temple grove, he stood there not unlike an eager child, in whom God speaks to his own glory, loosening his tongue, that it may give forth doctrine to the amazement of the doctors. "There is but one God," so he went joyously on, "but of God-likeness there is much in the world, and of the virtue of giving, which is neither male nor female, but lifted above sex, and has naught to do with dismemberment. Let me, O Lord, as I stand before thee, sing with lively tongue of that giving virtue. For mine eyes were opened in a dream, and I saw, as it were, a great and blessed house in a far land, its courts abounding in weal, with buildings, gardens, granaries, and shops, men and cattle in number like the sands of the sea. There thrift and prosperity ruled, sowing and reaping came to pass, the oil mills rested not, wine gushed from the vats and the presses, rich milk from the udders of kine, with golden sweetness from the honeycomb. But by whom did all this move in its appointed ways? And who was the source of this well-being? Ah, it came to pass through its master and head, and through him who owned it. For all went at his beck and nod, and all was moved by the breath of his nostrils. He said to one, Go, and he went, and to another, Do this, and it was done. And without him would have been no life, but all would have withered and perished. From his fullness all fed, his manservants and maidservants, and praised his name. Father and mother was he to the house and to all the estate, for the glance of his eye was like the moonbeam which fructified the cow and it gave birth to the god, and the breath of his mouth like the wind that bears the pollen from tree to tree, and out of the lap of his presentness gushed all beginning and prospering, as the golden honey gushes from the honeycomb. Thus dreamed I, far from here, of that virtue of giving, so that I perceive that there is a fruitfulness and a begetting which is not earthly after manner or sex, and not of the flesh, but of the Spirit and of God. Lo, the people dispute whether the fruit-bearing tree or the pollen-bearing one be male, and they agree not. And the reason, therefore, is that the Word is Spirit, and in the Spirit things contend. I saw a man, frightful was he to you, O my Lord, splendid in his might, and terrible in the strength of the flesh, a giant and a son of Enoch, and his soul was of neat's leather. Then went he out against lions, smote the wild ox, the crocodile, and rhinoceros, and laid them all low. And they asked him, Have you no fear? And he answered and said, What is fear? For he knew it not. But another child of man saw I in the world, tender of soul as in flesh, and he was afraid. Then he took shield and spear and spoke, Come on, my fear! And smote the lion, the wild ox, the crocodile, and the rhinoceros. Would you now, my lord, try your servant, and think to ask him, which of these men one should call by the name of man before the other? It might be that God would put his answer in my mouth. Potiphar stood leaning on his staff, so that he stooped a little. He felt a pleasant warmth in his head and limbs. Such a sense of well-being, it is said, came to those visited by a god in the guise of a wayfarer or beggar, or some acquaintance or relative, and they held speech together. For it was by this they knew him, or at least received happy intuition. The peculiar sense of well-being which streamed through them was a sign that he with whom they spoke might indeed be a wayfarer or beggar, a friend or relation, a fact to be taken account of by their sober sense and treated accordingly, but yet, considering that peculiar sense of well-being, to be thought of at the same time in the light of other and far-reaching possibilities. That all things may coincide in time is of their very nature and essence. Realities wear each other as disguises. The beggar is not less a beggar because a god has put him on. Is not the river a god, in the shape of a bull, or of a wreath-crowned man-woman with one breast of each sex? Did it not make the land, and does it not nourish it? Which does not forbid one to hold a common-sense attitude toward the water of the river, impersonal as itself, to drink it, to ride on it, to wash one's clothes in its stream, and only the sense of well-being as one drinks and bathes may suggest a higher point of view. The borderline between the earthly and the heavenly is fluid, and one need only fix one's eye upon a phenomenon for it to break up in diplope. Again, there are stages and pre-stages of the divine, half-gods, transitional existences, intimations. In the things which the youth by his tree had uttered about his previous life, much was familiar, much teasingly elusive and monitory. Much might be taken in a literary light. Even so, it was hard to say how far it rested upon assimilation and deliberate arrangement, and how much upon objective elements, traits which characterize the life of beneficent presences, beings by nature deific, consoling, saving, and redeeming. The young gardener knew these traits. He had made them spiritually his own, and knew how to bring his personal promptings in life into harmony with them. That might be an effect of his elusive intelligence. But Potiphar's striking sense of well-being spoke for the fact that the things themselves bore it out. He said, "I have tried you already, my friend, and you have stood the test not badly. Of course there can be no talk of virgin birth," he added, in a pleasantly instructive and admonitory tone, "simply because your birth was in the sign of the Virgin. That you can well see." He said this out of a sound sense of the practical side of things, and, as it were, not to let the god know that he knew him. "Go now," said he, "and take your rest with your fellows, and with tomorrow's sun take up your work again among my trees." With that he turned away, smiling and red of face, but after two paces brought his train to a halt again, and instead of turning back, beckoned Joseph to his side. "What is your name?" he asked. He had forgotten to do so before. Not until after a pause, which could not have been for reflection, Joseph, looking up gravely, replied, "Osarsif." "Good," responded the fan-bearer, short and crisp, and hastened his steps. Crisp, too, were his words. Best the dwarf heard and reported them to Joseph before an hour was out, when he told his steward Montcalm as they went, "That is an exceptionally clever slave there. Certainly the trees are in good hands with him, but you will scarcely be able to keep him at such work for long." "You have spoken," answered Montcalm, and knew what he had to do. Joseph makes a pact. Not idly have I introduced this conversation, of which elsewhere we have no record, word for word, with all its ins and outs, just as it came to pass. For it was the point of departure for Joseph's career in Potiphar's house. Its immediate sequel was that the Egyptian took him for his body servant, and later set him over his house, that he might put all that he had into his hands. The news of it has ridden us swiftly into the heart of the 7 years which raised the son of Jacob to new heights before casting him down to a new death. For in this test, which he had passed, he showed his understanding of the painful secret of the blessing house whereinto he had been sold, the need for mutual forbearance, tact, and flattering service to uphold its hollow dignity. And not only had he shown his understanding, but also his ability to perform the needed service better and more skillfully than anyone else. Such was in particular the experience of Montcalm, who found himself so far outrun by Joseph's incredible skill in his loyal endeavors for the health of their noble master's soul. I would expressly add, to the honor of the steward's good heart, and to point the difference between love and flattery, that he felt no pang of jealousy, but only joy. Indeed, it did not need the master's hint to decide him, after the encounter in the garden, to raise the slave at once out of the obscurity of his lowly state and put him in the way of higher testing. Long since, we knew that what had held the steward back was secret shame at those thoughts which had crossed his mind when Joseph stood before him with the roll, thoughts like to those which stirred in Potiphar during the talk in the garden. Hardly had the next day's sun seen Joseph after his morning meal at work in the garden as Kun Anpu's underling and helper to the wind, when Montcalm summoned him to come before him and announced decided changes in his employ. He found it good to say that these were overdue, and even in a sort to chide Joseph for the delay. How strange men are, and how they will twist the facts in their minds. The steward was pleased to be gruff, making announcement of his subordinate's good fortune in the odd form of a reproach, as though he had been guilty of lingering out by his own acts an untenable situation. He received the Hebrew slave in that part of the court which lay near the stables, between the women's house, the kitchens, and the servants' quarters. "Ah, there you are," said he, as Joseph saluted. "Well, that at least you come when you are called. Do you think it can go on like this forever, and you can play about in treetops to your day's end? You think falsely, let me tell you. But now we shall string the lute with other strings, for your days of idleness are over. You are to come into the house for service. With no more ado, wait upon the masters in the dining-room, hand the dishes, and stand behind the chair of Pharaoh's friend. You will not be asked if it likes you. Long enough you have played the laggard and run from the higher service, And your looks? Full of bark and dirt from the garden are your skin and linen. Go cleanse yourself. Get a silver apron from the stores for your waiter's service, and for your hair, a fitting garland from the gardener's. Or how else, then, did you think to stand behind Potiphar's chair?
I did not think to stand there, Joseph replied, very low.
It goes not after your thinking, and adjust your thoughts further to this. After the meal, you shall read aloud from the book rolls to the master, for he will try you before he sleeps in the northern columned hall where it is cool. Can you acquit yourself?
Tot will aid me, Joseph made bold to answer, trusting in the indulgence of him who had snatched him away to the land of Egypt, and speaking as Egyptians speak. But who is it who may read unto the master till now? He added.
Who till now? Amenemuia, it was, scholar of the bookhouse. Why would you know?
Because for the sake of the hidden one, I would step before no one steps, nor injure any man's boundary stone by taking away his office, which is his pride.